KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I have a great job at REI today, but there's no role that compares than the call to serve my country as Secretary of the Department of Interior.
What sense does it make to arm Seattle cops with this insidious, very lethal new technology called drones?
It was really callous disrespect of the united Garfield voice of students, parents, and teachers who have all voted unanimously that this test is not right for our school.
People upset about the MAP tests at Garfield, other places around the City of Seattle School District. People upset about drones, but some people excited for Sally Jewell to be nominated for Secretary of Interior, President Obama and Sally Jewell in particular. Joni Balter is here. C.R. Douglas is here. Knut Berger is here. We review the news of the week. A pleasure to see you all.
And you as
you
well.
You too.
Good morning.
With your scarf. Your hip.
I am wearing a scarf. Because
so Oregon. I don't know why.
Trying to get a whole new persona going.
I'm working on that. Flipping it back.
Yeah. It's like, kind of like the Red Baron.
It's interesting you mentioned the Red Baron, because there was a Red Baron, old classic Peanuts Red Baron this last Sunday, and the Red Baron was behind him the whole time. Got me thinking about the drones.
I thought it got you thinking about the scarf, but you know.
All right, Mayor McGinn, after a raucous hearing from in front of the Seattle City Council and a debate going back and forth about whether the City of Seattle Police Department should put unmanned aerial vehicles up in the sky for, I think, the 10 minutes was the max they could be up there to look at various things. That they said they weren't going to be used to spy on people. The Mayor McGinn said that we have other things we could do. A smart political move?
Oh, it probably was a political calculation. He heard that testimony and saw what was going on and just thought, why do I need this? Somebody call whoever sold us these things and see if they'll take them back.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. You can send them back.
I know, but nobody mentioned.
Yeah, the refund.
Send them back for what? For money back or just get them out of here? How did that go? It just became too politically costly, you know, some are saying. I wonder, though, I have one thought about drones. We mentioned this once before. You know, if you live near the water every summer, or even in the springtime sometimes, somebody gets stuck, lost in the water. And so they use these big helicopters to look to see if they can find whoever's missing. And I want to be on PC here, but was that a useful way to use a drone? In other words, what was the point of having these anyway?
Well, they argued,
what were they supposed to do for a living?
They argued that they could use them also at accident scenes. Again, they're up and down pretty fast because of their battery life. They're not using the long
battery. Not a good term around here, though.
They're not using those Boeing batteries. They're
apparently not. So there were there were positive aspects that the police department said they could get from these things. But in the end, the mayor mayor heard what was happening and said, we're not going to keep them. What did you think of the discussion, the debate, CR?
I thought he did the only thing he could really do politically was cut his losses and move on quickly. I mean, these were pretty much a train wreck from the minute the department got them last year. They had trouble ever articulating a good use for them. And conversely, the community had no trouble articulating all the problems with them, be that worries about surveillance, who are they going to follow, what are you going to do with all the tape that gets collected, privacy concerns, you know, all the rest. And all these people showed up at hearings and made the case that these just aren't ready for Seattle. You know, the best the department could do when we talk about, like, what uses could be made, I heard, you know, bodies in Lake Washington. But really, the quintessential drone use is a hostage situation on an upper story of a skyscraper where, for whatever reason, you can't sort of access it through the elevator and stairs, so you sort of buzz this drone up so it could see that. Well, tell me how often that happens. And our binoculars in the next door skyscraper just as good. I mean, it just didn't connect at all with what people see as the public safety problems in Seattle, be those street crimes, drugs, gun violence. I mean, drones weren't going to do anything for that. And they just ended up being, for McGinn, all cost and no benefit.
Do you see any value in the argument for drones?
Well, I didn't. I don't have anything against drones per se. I think if they had, if the police,
you'd like one.
He has one.
Come on.
If the Mossback drone. excuse me. I think if drones had been called model airplanes, I don't think it would have been. So I think there's a part of this that's tying into other concerns that are legitimate. I think the bigger concern, and there are two components to it. One is that the police department has bigger fish to fry. They often like to get new toys because they get grant money or they get federal money or something to buy something. They want to have that toy. And then they have to figure out, well, is this really useful, et cetera. And as CR and Joni were saying, I mean, the applications of these drones don't seem to be worth the hassle. They don't seem to be something that is really needed. The bigger issue that's kind of a longer term issue has been the kind of increasing, you know, militarization of police departments. If the Army has it, the police department gets it. That didn't used to be the case, but now it is, whether that's machine guns, tanks, anti-personnel, you know, we saw at WTO these huge...
All the stuff they used at WTO.
Carriers and whatnot. And the helmets, the bulletproof. You know, there's a way in which I think people are concerned about the way drones are being deployed by the military around the world, those things are flowing back because people see that if it's happening at that level, it's going to filter down to the local level.
Well,
and, the technology. The other part of this is that the bigger fish to fry that the police department has is regaining and building public confidence. And that, you know, clearly the outcry against the drones indicates that this would be a huge distraction that would be moving them in the wrong direction. So I think McGinn made exactly the right decision. Just get stop it.
You heard that in the testimony from lots of people, not just the angry shouting testimony, but the people who were keeping their voices modulated,
right.
That this was a trust issue.
It is a trust issue for a lot of people in the city. And, you know, timing is something here. You know, the mayor is trying to rebuild credibility, not just with the Department of Justice, also with the public that is wary. I thought this was interesting. If you link it up with the, and I can't say this long thing, automatic license plate recognition, ALPR, which is apparently grabbing all of our license plate information. And, you know, that's like the next frontier for this. But when I was reading the story about that, I was wondering, you know, and they said, you know, the people who were opposed to that were saying the danger is that sort of dangerous old boyfriends or something could figure out where you travel or know where you go. But if you think about that, don't they know that already? They know where you work. They know where your house is. They know where you, I don't know, where your gym is or whatever. So they, you know, it's not like, I just wondered about that because people have some information about you. And also the argument was made on that if any of us were really bored, we could go around and write down license plate numbers all day. They're available to the public just walking by.
Well, yeah, I mean, Joni, you're making a really good point, which is, I mean, the whole issue of privacy is one that, you know, is having to be sort of reexamined constantly. Some years ago, I got an unlisted phone number. And within about 5 days, it was available for $5 on the Internet. My unlisted number. There are technologies that, you know, invading our privacy of all kinds all the time. And much of it is we're actually incentivized to give up our privacy using Facebook or whatever. You get frequent flyer miles and you can be tracked.
I thought what was interesting about the vehicle licensing notation that exists they're already using that, for example, in the Crosscut article that Matt Bitsky for Kirk wrote, they don't have to chalk your tires anymore. And they can just take a picture of your license plate and they can swing back by. They'll know all that data, even if it's dumped at some point, all that data is being collected at a pretty rapid pace.
Well, the chalking, here's one for you. So What about if you go back and re-up? In other words, you're there. You deserve to be checked.
Well, let's hope they check.
Well, yeah. Well, so then they give you a ticket, but you just double paid?
No, let's hope they. Let's hope they're checking. Let's hope they're getting out of their cars.
In the rain?
Yeah. I just want to go back to the politics a little bit of drones and, you know, the mayor's race. As Skip said, you know, his biggest liability probably is police department. And,
Skip's Canute.
And Canute.
People don't know.
he's actually got three different...
He's vulnerable on police issues.
Yeah.
And the issue of mistrust. Everyone running against him is going to come at him from the left on police reform. No one's going to say he's done too much in that, right? They're all saying he hasn't moved far enough. He sort of resisted the monitor. He was a little bit in bed with the department, you know. So they're coming at him from the left on that, every major candidate. And drones just feeds this sort of problem he has, which is the department that doesn't have trust with the community. So get rid of that quickly, because you already have a problem, and you're going to have a problem with the campaign trail with your department anyway.
What do you make of it that this issue, Police Chief Diaz was very quiet, and the mayor took the point on getting rid of him?
Well, the police, let's just say very clearly, the police department was ambivalent about this. They never really got out in front of this with a huge amount of enthusiasm and a huge amount that we absolutely got to have it. They were ambivalent. As Canute said, this was a federal grant that got these. They sort of got them free on sale, if you will. it wasn't this long, drawn-out kind of agenda to get these things. It was sort of a technology in search of a problem. You know, Diaz has not been very visible in a lot of things recently. We can talk about that. But, you know, one more thing in this drone thing politically, you know, you have all these forums that these candidates are going to have between now and the election. And one thing that's just a staple of these forums are these lightning rounds, you know, do you agree with this? Yes, no. You know, you don't get an answer. All you got to do is hold up a paddle. Well, you do not want to be on the wrong side of drones. I mean, they're going to have all these community groups are going to say, do you want drones or not? You do not want to be the one guy in the panel that says yes. So McGinn had to get out of it.
And of course, an issue like the drones, people would have swamped those panels with that issue. That's
exactly
all we would have talked about.
First of all, I want to see the return receipt after these things are sent back, 30%, 40%. But the question about Diaz is very interesting because, he's often quiet, as you suggested. He's not a showy guy. And if you've seen him, I remember during the appointment and confirmation hearings down at City Hall, he's very self-effacing, self-deprecating. He's not a, hey, this was my idea, this wasn't my idea. He's a quiet person. And also, this mayor's race already has the element of one of the candidates, Councilmember Tim Burgess, saying that he would fire the police chief. And so, you know, what would be the right role on this? But we cannot just act like somebody didn't apply for the grant that produced the delivery of these drones. They came from somewhere. Somebody typed up a grant and said, can we have these? So that is part of the story.
What else do you have to say about Police Chief Diaz being very quiet these days?
Well, he's not great in public. He acknowledges that. I think the gun buyback, I wasn't as close to that story, but it feels like, you know, the assistant chief Metz was kind of one of the public guys in the gun buyback. But, you know, he's in a tough situation, the mayor. When now his, you know, one of his major competitors calls for the oust of the police chief, I feel like he's probably at that point locked into keeping the police chief. I mean, right now, if he got rid of the police chief, it'll look like he just caved to pressure from this guy. So I think he's his chief now. I think he gets to the election with this guy. But I think there is, you know, it's going to come up in the community conversations.
Bruce Harrell was working on the proposed ordinance that would have put some kind of governance or restriction limits on the use of these unmanned aerial vehicles.
I feel a little bit, I mean, in some ways, Bruce Harrell takes as big a hit on this. I mean, he was sort of trying to come up with these policies And got a lot of flack at that hearing, got a lot of flack the last couple of weeks from all these community groups, you know, as he was sort of defending drones. I mean, the mayor sort of handed him a hot potato and then left the room.
And no, he then went up to him. He said, so you're holding these hearings. I haven't heard a single good word about drones at your hearings. I'll just call up and send these babies back.
The mayor went up to him.
Right.
Interesting.
Right.
All right, let me take a break, come back, and let's talk about the discussion of drones in relation to various nominees, but also the larger question on the other Washington. That's coming up on Weekday.
Support for KUOW comes from Half Price Books, buying and selling new and used books, music, movies, and more. A wide selection of hardbacks, paperbacks, DVDs, LPs, and CDs at every location. More information and store locations at hpb.com.
41 degrees in Seattle. We've still got quite a few clouds, but the forecast still says it's going to be mostly sunny later, and we expect to reach a high of 46.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance's new Proton Therapy Center, a partnership with ProCure Treatment Centers. SCCA's new Proton Therapy Center allows doctors to precisely target cancerous tumors while minimizing effects on surrounding tissue. More at sccaprotontherapy.com.
It's 1021, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
We are reviewing the news of the week with C.R. Douglas of Q13 Fox News analyst. Are you tweeting yet?
Yes.
I'm trying to give everybody their tweet handles because we're all in the same flock.
C.R. Douglas at C.R. Douglas Q13 Fox.
Q and the Q13 Fox. And the 13 is the number.
Correct.
And you are?
At Jay Balter.
Yeah. And you're not even bothering.
That's right. I got an unlisted number.
But not on Facebook. He's pretty heavy duty there.
That's right. You can come down and be my Facebook friend.
That's right. Kate Berger, that's who that
is. I thought, Steve, during the break, you made an interesting point about the gun buyback.
Well,
I could be so bold.
When I was down there trying to talk to folks about the gun buyback and actually trying to get numbers and what did you get, you know, some more specifics. The folks that were the police folks were saying, you know, this isn't entirely our event, and the mayor's going to make the announcement on Monday. This was Saturday, and you know, from that, I think it's easy to say there was a lot of politics in this.
Well, think about this: Mayor Bloomberg is, you know, sort of cheerleading nationally on mayors who are active against guns, and you know, I am tweet pals with Mayor Bloomberg, and he does about 10 of these a day. And I just have this sense, maybe from that the mayors of various U.S. cities want to be active on this and want to have a voice. And so I think McGinn is trying to say, I'm part of this group.
We're part of it. All right. On the other side, Brennan was grilled about the drone programs. The Obama administration released some information about their rationale for targeting U.S. citizens who are fighting against us in foreign countries. Of course, people are raising the spectrum of, you know, where does it start? When do the unmanned drones start flying over our airs? That's the spectrum they raise. But specter they raise, perhaps the spectrum too. We heard some reports about people in Yemen who were psychologically unhinged because they hear drones flying over their heads all the time, and they are worried about when the next bomb is going to fall. Is this going to be Barack Obama's – this is strong, I know, but is this Barack Obama's Vietnam problem? I mean, is this going to be something that a liberal Democratic president is going to be facing in his legacy?
Well, okay, so this is happening. It's part of the hearings, so it's primetime live, shall we say. But it just sort of depends on what happens next, I think, on that front. You know, is he going to ramp it up, ramp it down, try to explain himself? I mean, that's where it lies. It's what's next. Because they already know that it's been going on. It's not like, oh, my gosh, is it maybe going on? It's going on.
Well, they want to hold hearings on it.
I don't think it'll be as Vietnam. I mean, the progressives hate this. But if you look at the polls, 75% plus of Americans approve of the drone program. So it's not one of these things that he's doing without public support. You know, Vietnam was a war that kept killing people, Americans, you know. The key about drones are they are unmanned. They're sort of targeted killing, if you will. I mean, there's collateral, of course, but no Americans, you know, servicemen are in jeopardy. No service women are in jeopardy. I mean, so they're kind of a cheap and easy war tool in a way.
That is the key. What do you think? Is it, well, does it hurt him at all?
Well, I think it, well, yes, it does hurt him. I mean, it also helps him. I think it's important for the administration to be transparent to a point about why it's doing what it's doing, who it's doing it to, and what the legal rationales are. So I think forcing them to come up with that information is a positive thing. I think that the nature of war is not a stable thing. All wars are different from other wars. I mean, they're not different in the sense that people get killed and a lot of innocent people get killed, but they're different in terms of the technologies, the tactics, and the nature of those, you know, particular conflicts. And so the rules of war have to be adjusted as you go along. And that's that isn't just a George W. Bush thing. You know, that's a Barack Obama thing. That's a Bill Clinton thing. That's a Harry Truman thing. I mean, it's an Abraham Lincoln thing. And so I think one of the things that – I mean, certainly not that these things are – it's an either or, but using targeted drones to kill enemies on foreign soil is better than nuking a city like Hiroshima. You know, in other words,
our gradations of
that's a
of
well.
War.
I'm just saying that what, you know, one of the reasons we dropped the atomic bomb was to terrorize a country into surrender, in a war and killing a lot of civilians to do so. Drones offer a really different way of conducting war in a way that at least ideally is supposed to be much more targeted and much limiting the damage and certainly limiting to your own. Your casualties, as CR was pointing out. So I think what's happening is what happens in conflicts and should happen in conflicts, which is a public debate about the rules of war. And those rules are not set in stone. They do change over time. They change with technology. They change with strategy. And they change with the nature of the threat that you're fighting.
The interesting thing, of course, is how much war are Americans willing to sort of put up with? And so as support has waned quite a bit, for Afghanistan and earlier for Iraq, this is like limited war. Are you willing? And I didn't know that number that CR mentioned of American support, but that says that's a really interesting number because it's saying that Americans want most of the military folks home. They're not willing to keep these wars going on and on. But yeah, if you're going to do this unmanned thing and keep us safe, maybe that's the comfort level.
Yeah.
It's how much war? That's the question.
We are blazing the trail in a new kind of war, and we control the technology now, but 20 years from now, we may not.
Well, and I think just to sort of pick up on Canute, we learned a little bit more about the drone program from these hearings. I mean, John Brennan made it clear, and it wasn't up to now, that it's not retribution, but imminent threats. So we're not just targeting people that were once, you know, nasty to the U.S. It's people that are imminent threats. Now, that's a very, very difficult thing to define, but at least it was a sense of we're trying to stop things that may happen, not punish people for what they have done in the past. So, you know, rules are sort of some of what has been happening is coming out in public, and we were sort of developing rules and standards. And the fact of the matter is, in not too many years, all kinds of countries are going to have these. And so, you know, developing some kind of rule is kind of key because that'll be the precedent that is set for the rest of the world.
Well,
the only thing I'd add to that is people who aren't countries are also going to have them.
Right.
And that's going to be even,
it's
you know.
It's like the gun buyback program, that
exactly.
Missile thing.
Yeah, we'll find the Second Amendment apparently is going to cover armed drones at some point. It's a technology that.
I'm not carrying, but I do have an armed drone overhead.
Yeah,
who's aiming
at you right as we speak, you know.
Right.
Anyway, it's going to get a lot more complicated in the future.
Would you like a segue?
No, one last thing. I mean, it's interesting to watch the president in 60 Minutes and others justifying this, arguing for why it's a policy, and thinking about the fact that he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, there you go.
For his work in bringing a more peaceful world to bear. Did you have a different segue?
My different segue was
practicing segues
to say
today.
That maybe, because we were talking about that earlier, was maybe his desire to have a quieter hearing explains the big news of the week for Seattle.
Nice.
Was that good?
That is good.
Sally Jewell, REI CEO, to be U.S. Interior Secretary. And I don't know this for sure, but it sure seems like it's going to be a pretty quiet hearing with the sound volume turned down.
Somebody who has business backing.
Oil drilling, banking, and can climb mountains and shoot down rivers.
Well, I thought it was very interesting that a gentleman named Tim Egan, who we've talked to from time to time, I believe you know him as well, he wrote in the Opinionator column today, his argument was, isn't it going to be interesting to have somebody who actually is of that constituency, that is the major constituency, that really uses these public lands, which are urban people who want to be out hiking and not the people who are drilling or mining.
She covers her bases because, yes, she is the urban user of the great outdoors. So she understands that. She's on that National Park Conservation Group. She has, you know, park cred, let's call it. But at the same time, she started her career in banking specifically related to oil companies. That's going to be a quiet hearing, right?
What do you think of her nomination?
I think it's really interesting. And generally, I'm encouraged about it for a couple reasons. I mean, as Joni said, she kind of crosses that divide. She's got the experience with mobile oil and banking on one side. She has the REI and her own passion for the outdoors. One part of and there's this, you know, the Interior Department has this interesting dual role, which is facilitating the exploitation of public lands on the one hand, and also then protecting a certain public lands from. And I've been writing about this recently, the problems with the national parks and the concerns they have. They have the same concerns that the Republican Party has about the changing demographics in this country, because what they're seeing is extremely low minority participation in national parks and a fairly aging population. That's soon to be a minority population in this country in terms of race, being the prime users of national parks. And I think one of the companies that's been really getting how to sell the interest in the outdoors to urban people is REI. REI has had a very aggressive diversity program, not both in terms of its employees, but also in terms of how it approaches retail markets.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting because she has a lot of experience on the exact problem that the National Park Service has to solve. And it's not just the national parks, because it extends to the national forests and others, which is how do you keep a commitment to preserving these places over time when your main constituency is dying out?
And she worked very hard on a program to bring inner city young people to the outdoors.
Exactly.
That is something she's known for. So it actually, it hits all those notes there. Yeah. I ran into Sally Jewell last week.
Climbing a mountain?
No. It was more like a coffee shop.
Okay.
Thanks for asking. I appreciate that. So I asked her, because this is what's funny, because a couple of years ago, talking about women mayor potentials, I had just put her name in a column to say, you know, women like her maybe could run for mayor. She definitely wasn't interested in that. She wrote me a funny note at the time about how everyone, if she were mayor, everyone would have to eat freeze-dried three times a day or something like that. It was pretty funny. But so then I picked up on that when I saw her not on the mountain in the coffee shop, and said something about, you know, gosh, did you read the story everybody's talking about? Which woman would run for mayor, because Seattle only had one woman mayor back in 1926 to 28. And she just was talking about, you know, she didn't have the fire in the belly for that. But it turns out she already knew about all this. So that was just Talk about being behind.
What do you think of her?
I think it's a great choice. And I think her resume kind of perfectly fits what's needed in that role. Just to expand on what Knut said, I mean, there is this tension with a department like this. On the one hand, it oversees all these recreational areas and national parks. And on the other hand, it is in the business of leasing off rights for mineral, you know, and natural resource extraction. And more so now than probably ever. I mean, we are having this natural gas boom and oil shale boom and all kinds of things in this country. And a lot of that is happening under, you know, federal lands that the Department of Interior, you know, controls. So leaseholds for all those companies are huge. And you can just see the tension there between environmentalists on the one hand and companies, you know, oil companies especially on the other. And hello, Sally Jewell is a former oil company person and she's an environmentalist. So she fits exactly the profile of what this job probably needs. Everyone sees kind of something they like in her from both those constituencies. I mean, if this was a pure sort of environmentalist, the sort of business community would be outraged. If she was a pure oil company person, the environmentalists would be outraged. The only thing she lacks is political experience. And typically, you know, a lot of times former governors, former, you know, local interior secretaries get this kind of job. She doesn't have that. And the question is, is she up for the rough and tumble of D.C. politics coming as a pretty unknown entity without a sort of big political job in her resume?
The other thing I would mention as a positive, just from being from the Pacific Northwest, is that often these jobs go to guys from Colorado or Arizona, or, you know, the kind of a Rocky Mountain West type of thing. Here we've got an Interior Secretary not only from the West Coast but from the Pacific Northwest, and it'll just be interesting to see what kind of a stamp she puts on it. She certainly has a at-home constituency that is dealing with those balance issues that CR talked about, but also is passionate about what she's passionate about.
But you also have coal trains as an issue. You have cleanup of Puget Sound as an issue. You have expanding national parks as an issue. All things that she could bring from the Northwest to Interior that hasn't been at the top of their list in the past.
Yeah, exactly.
And also one of the discussion points this week wasn't Governor Christine Gregoire up for this same job? And what does this mean about any future jobs for Chris Gregoire? She wasn't really talking about it. She went a little quiet there, but they were up for the same job from everything we've heard.
Well, if you wanted a quieter hearing, you sure wouldn't want a politician who has all sorts of issues behind her.
I mean, the political thing the lack of political experience for Sally Jewell becomes a positive when you get into a Senate confirmation hearing room, because where are they going to get all the information to kind of go, this day you said,
that day you said.
I mean, she has given speeches plenty. There's plenty on YouTube about preserving parks and helping young people who are not in the outdoors get in the outdoors. But
senators are just going to go, Ms. Jewell, I have a problem with this coat. Can I return it at the RIA?
I mean, Ken Salazar, the current Interior Secretary, got quite high marks from both sides of the sort of, you know, tension there on this front, you know, sort of industry versus environmentalists. He added a number of national parks during the last 4 years, and he increased lease rights for industry. And my guess is in the next 4 years, the exact same thing's going to happen. I think under Sally Jewell, you'll probably have more national parks named, more national wilderness areas, et cetera, and you'll probably increase leaseholds to industry.
The one bit of political experience that she apparently does have, Sally Jewell, is that she had worked from her various capacities on new wilderness areas and expanded wilderness areas. Senator Patty Murray has said that a couple of times.
And she worked on the Mountain to Sound Greenway Project. Mm-hmm. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back and see if we can hit all these other topics in the next 15 or so minutes. This is Weekday.
Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore. A Memory of Light from Tor is the final volume of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time series. Writer Brian Sanderson has finished the story and is appearing with Jordan's widow, Harriet McDougall, on Tuesday, February 12th, 7 p.m. at University Temple United Methodist Church.
It was revealed this week that President Obama has claimed the power to fire a Predator drone at any U.S. citizen anywhere in the world for any reason he likes. I'm Peter Sagal. On this week's Wait, Wait, it's President Obama, husband, father, statesman, and great guy who we would never offend, ever. Join us for the news quiz that keeps watching the skies and flinching. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW and Seattle's Chinatown International District present the Lunar New Year Festival, featuring a neighborhood food walk, lion and dragon dances, and other cultural performances. February 9th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. in and around Hinghe Park. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
43 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 46. We got some clouds and fog right now, but the forecast says expect lots of sun later. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1040.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scherer. We're reviewing the news of the week with Knute Berger, C.R. Douglas, Joni Balter. You know, last week we talked about the taking down of the ramps to nowhere. And a listener was inspired by that. A listener who's a photographer, Jeff Lance, who's been taking pictures and thinking about the ramps to nowhere. I think some of them he went out and took and some of them he had. He went out and sort of documented the ramps as they exist today. And then he made a big poster and he brought us a poster of them. So we'll take a picture of it and put it on the old Facebook so you folks
can
see.
What about
the
old website?
The old ramps to nowhere. Yeah, we'll try to get it on the website too. We'll try on that. And then this will go next to the quilt.
It is kind of a quilt itself, yeah. Isn't it?
Because we got a quilt a few weeks ago from a listener who gave us a KUOW Washington State quilt. So this is very much like a quilt, all these little pictures. So thanks, Jeff.
Very cool.
And yeah, Joni's right. What else are you inspired to make?
Here comes lunch, laundry. I'm just seeing it.
I was thinking of a drone.
I'm not sure it was totally clear that we're talking about the Arboretum ramps to nowhere.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, not the ramps to nowhere that exist.
The 520 ramps that never got
Yes,
used.
Thank you. I sometimes forget context. I appreciate that. And it is a problem. Have you guys followed the MAPS test and the controversy over this measure of student achievement, or whether it is a measure of student progress or not? Jose Banda said teachers boycotting at Garfield, I don't care. Substitutes are coming in, and they're going to give the...
They made the administrators.
Yeah, or the yes. administrators. You're giving the...
And then the students didn't show up. This thing is sort of...
And now the parents are in arms.
They're afraid they're going to get the test. But the thing is that this is blowing up, maybe not at the best time, since there's those double levies next week. Very, you know, big numbers. I don't think it's given a sense that, you know, it's got this sort of school out of control thing. So here, this is a required test. The teachers don't want to give it. The students don't want to take it. The parents don't like it. But then you have your relatively new superintendent come in and say, you shall give it. Well, who will you give it to if the kids aren't in the seats?
He took it as a challenge
of administration. And, you know, I saw one, I don't know if it was a comment on the story or a blog post somewhere, but somebody was saying it'd be like if you were running a business and you told your employees we're going to do X, whatever X is. And then the employees came in and said, we're not doing X. I mean, there is a little bit of that to this. That was one of the comments I read. Who knows how this is going to end? It just keeps going.
Do you think the teachers are right or wrong on this issue? Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, I have some sympathy with the teachers on this. I mean, it's a tricky test. It's high stakes. I suspect it's just a prediction that the district will probably blink on this in some ways. I mean, student testing like this is very much the sort of ed reform kind of cause celeb, and the sort of teachers and unions have kind of resisted this kind of thing. There are all kinds of reasons why this isn't a great test. It takes a lot of time. You're giving it three times a year. You know, it's disruptive, that kind of stuff. I mean, I think some kind of test is in order, but my guess is with the rebellion that's happening with 100 teachers so far, you know, you got parents, you got this teachers union, Jose Banda is not an ed reform guy. I mean, he was brought in above the other candidates who were much more before, much more committed to this kind of, you know, new way of doing stuff and student testing. The ed reformers lost in the last election. So the sort of board is full of people that are probably more sympathetic with teachers on this. I think he's probably a little bit more sympathetic with teachers. So my guess is they'll come to some kind of compromise where this is scaled back, maybe not tested as much. I don't see him going to the mat against his teachers on this.
It's not the first time folks have fought tests that were required. Remember the WASL, Washington Assessment of Student Learning. So we had that test for a while, and it was the thing that was going to really get us where we're going, right? Except then they started having these opt-outs for different phase-in years and topics. You know, science was supposed to be, and oh, heck, we can't get to that till later. And, you know, these tests are very controversial, and they do cause a lot of stress. I mean, but if they're measure, then maybe, you know, then maybe that's the calculation. If they measure what's being learned and help students advance, and the argument against this test seems to be that it doesn't do that.
If at all, how does this dovetail with what the Republicans in the state Senate are trying to come up with, which are grades for schools?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was listening to Rodney Tom at a press conference this week and talking about ed reform and how just pouring more money into the system isn't good enough. You know, we've already done that. We have to change the system itself. But then he starts talking about inputs and outputs, and it's almost like the Microsoft mentality of making everything reliant on a metric. Has just overtaken the ed reform part of it. You don't hear a lot about other education reform, which is anti-test, which goes in a different direction of individualized learning and funding earlier education and that kind of thing. And so, I mean, I think this rebellion is great. I mean, I'm against tests. I'm against Steve Litzo was talking about, you know, grading the schools A through F. I think that's a stupid idea. And I think there's a problem in that there does need to be education reform, but it's been seized by a kind of corporate mentality that thinks that everybody is a widget. And that testing is going to be the measure. And I think it's wrong to give kids tests that don't work for kids, but then become the measure by which the teacher is judged.
So you
corrupt the – even if you think testing is a good idea, you corrupt the process, because then you get an overemphasis on teaching to a test that doesn't necessarily benefit the overall education of a student. But the teachers know that, you know, their butt's in a sling if the kids don't pass it. And so you get too much teaching to test that, you know. So I think it's actually good that it's coming up right now, because I think the education reform debate has gotten too channeled into, you know, teachers' unions versus
charter schools.
Or just reformers who want to measure everything. That's the worst of both worlds, I think.
It seems that if you're going to give a test, there has to be buy-in. And what I remember, and this actually didn't end up working, but at least it had a chance to work, when they were bringing in the WASL, there was this huge rollout period, time to go school to school, district to district, and explain the test, explain the value of the test, explain the value of the test to the students, the parents, and the teachers. And it didn't end up working out, but it seems to me that if you have a test, you have to explain its value, you have to prove its value, and you have to roll it out in such a way that there's buy-in.
Many of the reformers have talked about individual student plans, and that's the way we need to move forward, because it's the individual student we're working on. But they cost a lot of money, and they cost a lot of resources. And so I'm looking for a way that the people who want to see real reform, not testing reform like you're talking about, are going to be able to push the individual students' needs to the forefront. I mean, part of the problem was third graders being advanced who can't read, right? That's part of the argument they gave for these tests.
Well, there is a huge movement for sort of outcomes and achievements and you know, I mean, you want to know that the progress is happening. So there's an understandable motivation by lawmakers on both sides. But one thing that's going on here, too, is that the city of Seattle is demanding some accountability with the district. I mean, they put in this families and education levy, millions every year, and so there's not just sort of Republicans from outside of Seattle. I mean, it's kind of the Democrats on the city council that want to know that they're getting something out of their money. MAPS is,
that's the name of the test.
Yeah. It's flawed, but it attempts to do what Knut is saying. I mean, this is a computer-based test, which isn't just, you know, the same test everyone gets. I mean, the idea is you sort of answer, and if you have trouble with one answer, it bumps you to kind of an easier route to go down, and then it may bump you back depending on how you go. So it is very individualized, is the concept. And it tries to be a measure of where students are at, and gives them a sense of how they're doing over the course of the year. You're supposed to give it three times a year. So not perfect, but it will be defended, I will say, on those kinds of grounds.
All right. I noticed that just to jump completely to another subject, the NTSB chief on Thursday, talking about the government and Boeing, he was harsh to both some of the people that were involved in accepting the battery in the 787, but also harsh towards Boeing for saying that they had certified a battery themselves for what they were using. I was wondering how much of this was agency capture, regulatory capture, and that Boeing had the right to look and test its own equipment.
Well, they didn't meet the criteria here in the early rollout. So there were some numbers, and I maybe you could help me with those, but there were supposed to be, you know, this failure rate that was extreme, like, you know, 1 in 10 million hours,
right,
or something.
In once the first, in 10 million hours of
flight. Is that the right? Okay. And so then in the first 100,000 hours, they had these incidents. And so that's, these numbers are not close. You know, that is, and so the NTSB sounded very harsh, like, you know, those planes wouldn't be flying except for the one that they're testing.
Well, as you quoted people saying, Boeing didn't even meet the reduced standards that they had argued for, they put into place, that have been put into place.
Right.
You were thinking about the Boeing situation in terms of what, I mean, is there some regulatory capture involved here? Did Boeing?
Part of the problem is, you know, that Boeing is in such a unique position in terms of what it means to the American economy.
Yeah. Too big to fail.
Too big to fail.
Especially in Puget Sound.
And I think there's a, in terms of our export business and whatnot, there's nothing that's comparable. So, you have, you know, built into the system, you have both the, obviously Boeing has an incentive to make sure every plane that it makes flies and works. So they don't want to lose public confidence. So you think, well, okay, they're going to be testing this plane in such a way that it's in their interest for it, you know, not to cut corners, et cetera. But when you have something that's essentially a really new technology in terms of how it's being used and what it's being used for, you, I think, also have the incentive to sort of see what you want to see, you know, and call it good maybe before it was ready. So it's interesting because I think everybody really wanted to get this plane in the air, and the further the delays and the more problems there were in the production process, the more the pressure was to get it going. And, you know, I'm sure they'll fix it.
Oh yeah,
you know.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's good to relook at the whole process.
This is the most outsourced plane ever built, and we were talking a couple weeks ago here, and we were just surmising about that. We didn't have enough information at the time. Could that have something to do with it? And then that became, you know, one of the possible explanations for what has happened. It was very, you know, the testing, what was going on. It's hard when it's made all over the globe.
And in the meantime, the SPIA engineers are voting on whether to strike or not. And Boeing has made its final offer. All right. Boy Scouts didn't lift their ban on gays. Did the Boy Scouts come across? They punted. How'd they come across, CR? How'd they come across in this issue?
Well, I think they're losing public support. But they're in this quandary where they're in so many ways connected with religious institutions and with local chapters who, you know, are in places that don't support it. So it's very tough for the Nationals to suddenly, you know, end the ban and require that of all their local chapters. It's hard to see how the culture is moving so fast that the Boy Scouts will be able to keep this up for that much longer.
I have to say, as somebody who was in the Boy Scouts, I didn't know that they were banned, especially the leaders. I didn't know they were banned. They were very nice people. I didn't know they were banned. Did you make a joke about Chris Christie? Were you dissing?
I wasn't dissing Chris Christie.
I did make a joke about Chris Christie, sort of in the blog post today. I was just so yesterday. Everybody was all sort of talking about how Chris Christie had told the former White House Dr. Connie Mariano. She was saying from afar that she'd be interested in him running for president in 2016, but she had concerns from afar. She's out in the West, that he'd die in office because he's so large. This prompted Christie to come out and do this press conference and tell her to shut up. But the funniest thing, the thing that I picked up on today was, if you watch the video, there's a guy to the right of Christie, and he's like an officer or bodyguard or an aide or something. And as Christie is talking in his absolute full New Jersey, this guy is just falling apart laughing because he knows his what appears to be his boss is just going off. He's just going, and this guy's cracking up, and then he puts his head down trying to not crack up. It's just that's my part of it that I enjoyed.
I mean, Chris Christie has to settle on a strategy for this. He decided he would start talking about it. Kind of hasn't really talked about it.
Being overweight,
laughed about it, goes on Letterman, eats a donut, kind of says, I'm struggling with it, I'm trying, I'm dieting, I'm exercising, and then, you know, I thought dealt with it pretty well. And then he does this 180, you know, a week later, and starts snipping at a doctor.
Who started the snippy?
Well, I thought she said something that was sort of uncontroversial. And so then he's getting defensive again and not laughing about it. And how dare you say this to me? And da, 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 da. So he's got to figure out what it is. Is he sort of going to laugh about his weight and eat donuts? Or is he going to get mad at anyone who brings it up?
But he was unhappy because his son, his 12-year-old, had seen something that said this doctor who definitely hasn't examined you, said you're going to die.
You're going to die.
Daddy,
right.
Are you
going to
die?
He's a walking time bomb or something. Yeah. Something of that. And he didn't want his kids seeing that. I mean,
I get your point.
But one of the funny things is, if, you know, Chris Christie's this grumpy now, what's he going to be like if he goes on a diet? you know, watch out.
Well, President Obama, of course, he had cigarettes as an issue. He didn't make it front and center, but you knew it was there. You knew it was somebody he was dealing with. I mean, Christie could adopt that strategy, right?
Well, I think the difference is, was it there? I mean, we sort of heard about it, but no one ever saw it.
People saw it.
It's unavoidable.
It's not like
Chris
see it every time you look at him.
Yeah,
it's different
I see.
That way. It's different that way.
All right. Yeah. You just wanted to say something about Richard III's bones, did you not?
Well, he's so heavily into bones.
That was just a story I could not let go of this week. Yeah, Steve. It was sort of it's like England's Kennewick Man. In it.
Oh, that's good.
You know, just a fascinating story about both history and, you know, forensic anthropology and I'm also fascinated with the sort of silliness of these facial reconstructions that they do. You know, here's what Kennewick Man started out looking like Jean-Luc Picard, and now he looks like somebody from Game of Thrones. I mean, it's like, they had these facial reconstructions of Richard III that looked just exactly like, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio playing Richard III. It was like, and of course, it was done by a group that's trying to rehabilitate Richard III's image. And anyway, so I just got a really big kick out of the science of it and also the politics.
Richard III's bones were found underneath the parking lot in the
Leicester.
In the UK. And soon he will be resurrected.
We'll have some facial
and now there's
reconstruction.
There's a big fight over where to rebury him
between
Leicester and York. So it's just great stuff.
Well,
Yes. Yes, we should do that with our politicians. Oh, we have, actually. We buried them and then unearthed them.
That's right. Abraham Lincoln, for
That's
one.
That's right. Knut Berger is the Mossback at crosscut.com. He's author of Pugetopolis and Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. C.R. Douglas is a political analyst for Q13 Fox News and shows up from time to time on KCTS9 as well. Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Have an excellent weekend.
And you too.
Talk to you folks on Monday. Al Gore next week. We'll see what he has to say about Richard III.
It's 43 degrees in Seattle, anticipating sun today, and a high of 46. A very different story on the other side of the country. As we know, it's snowing across the Northeast as that region embarks on a perhaps historic snowstorm. In a minute here, we're going to get an update on that and find out how public utilities across New England are preparing for the storm. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Arlington Arts Council, presenting Sweet and Hot, a concert featuring songs of Harold Arlen, composer of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Saturday, February 9th at the Burns Performing Arts Center. Details at arlingtonartscouncil.net and tickets at brownpapertickets.com.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.